This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Rhonda Boyd, Associate Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania and a psychologist in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Behavioural Sciences at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Rhonda is a specialist in adolescent depression and cognitive behavioural therapy. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with the rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Rhonda, thank you for joining me. Can you start by introducing yourself?
Yes, thank you, Jo. I've been at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine for about 19 years now. My research is focused on maternal depression, its impact on children, also conducting preventive interventions in mostly low-resourced, racially diverse populations of women and families. And more recently, I've been expanding my research to be more aligned with my clinical work. So I've been focusing more on youth depression and suicide risks in my research. I have been doing this work with colleagues as part of CHOP's Child and Adolescent Mood Program, which is a clinical program, but also has a research component in which we have a data registry and repository of patients who come into our clinic to be evaluated. And so we've been doing that for a number of years and are in the process of writing up papers and expanding that research.
And how did you come to be interested in child and adolescent mental health?
So it's interesting. As a child, I used to read a lot, and I always had a book. And sometime during adolescence, I started reading books about mental health, and that's when it sparked. I began to understand as I read these books that early childhood experiences are very important, influence later development into adulthood. And that sparked my interest. And when I went to college at Brown University, I was able to major in psychology, and my interests took off. I took as many classes as I could that focused on child and adolescent mental health. And then I went into graduate school to study clinical psychology and a focus on child and adolescent psychology.
Right. It sounds unusual to be reading books on mental health when you were quite young.
It wasn't the only thing I read, but I was one of those people who read a lot of different genres. And I believe it was actually my eighth grade teacher. She began exposing me to different types of books, and she gave me, it was like a true story about someone with mental health problems. And that's what started. And then I kept reading it.
Rhonda, as you've already described, your research interests include adolescent and maternal depression, prevention and health disparities. And you've conducted several studies examining at-risk children and mothers. Can you explain the relationship between mothers who are at risk and the implications for their children?
Yes. It's been an extensive research literature showing that maternal depression has been associated with a great deal of negative consequences for children in many domains, such as increased psychopathology, developmental delays, medical conditions, substance abuse, and poor functioning that goes on into adulthood. And so this has been well documented. One of the things in general, parental psychopathology, so fathers do matter, that does come up often, is not as much research as there are on mothers, but even father's psychopathology has been associated with poor outcomes for youth. And one of the areas that they've looked at is sort of how is this transmitted. And so parenting deficits have been noted, looking at that parents with depression may be more intrusive in their parent. They may have poor attachment to their children. And so the parent-child interaction becomes an important way in which psychopathology may be transmitted. Also, children of depressed moms have increased negative life events. Some of those that occurs because of the mother's experiences, but their own individual negative life events. And then there's these biological mechanisms. There's genetic predisposition. And then when you look at perinatal depression, there may be biological mechanisms that are happening while a woman is pregnant that sort of could put a youth at risk for developing psychopathology later.
We know suicidal behavior is highly familial, and I want to turn to a paper that you co-authored that appeared in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, the JCPP, which explored the association between family history of suicide attempt and neurocognitive functioning in community youth. Can you give a brief summary of your explorations and also some of the findings?
One of the things is that looking at, from my interest in maternal depression, it was interesting to be able to look at more suicide risk and how that fit into putting youth at risk. And looking at the mechanisms, as I had mentioned before, trying to understand what is happening. And so colleagues from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and the University of Pennsylvania, we came together to look at this large database. They have a database of almost 10,000 youth and their parents who also participated, and was able to gather those in that sample who actually had a family history of suicide attempt. So this is first degree relatives, parents or siblings. And we included both non-fatal and fatal suicide attempts. So we were able to identify 501 youth who were between the ages of 8 and 21. And so we match those participants based on age, sex, race, and lifetime depression with participants who did not have a family history. And then we looked at their neurocognitive functioning based on computerized tests. And so what we found is that those youth with the family history of suicide attempts had lower executive functioning than the other youth. And in particular, they had low in areas of attention span and language reasoning. We were able to identify, and that supports some of the other literature looking at those neurocognitive deficits. There's just not a lot of research focused on children and adolescents. And so this was an area which we could realize that could lead to some implications for interventions, and particularly because it was a large sample that we were able to notice these differences.
So what are the implications then of your findings regarding family history of suicide and neurocognitive functioning, I suppose in terms of prevention and treatment of suicidal behaviors in young people?
It does suggest that executive functioning may be an area that you want to focus on for interventions for at-risk youth, because these kids were not treatment-seeking youth. They were community youth, and that you already were seeing these neurocognitive deficits, which has implications for later behavior. And so we know when someone has a suicide attempt, we know when there's people die by suicide in the family. And so we could focus on the kids in the family to be able to see how they're functioning and to be able to work on these areas. Also, the finding about youth, the language reasoning, indicate they're sort of helping you verbalize their thoughts and feelings, problem solving, and understanding the consequences of their behaviors are areas that we can focus on in therapy. And cognitive behavior therapy is a type of therapy that can address those issues, and being able to kind of help with those kind of neurocognitive executive functioning tasks will be helpful for youth possibly. Also, I think it's important for us to gather information about family suicide history when a youth is presenting for mental health treatment. Many times people may have a short time to gather a lot of information, but knowing this, that someone has a family history, sort of would help guide the treatment and treatment planning.
So can I check something? So if you saw a youth with a family history of suicide who showed certain cognitive deficiencies, let's say, would that suggest to you that the risk is higher in that child?
I would think that that was an area that I would want to focus on, that that could be, because it would make me concerned that, you know, when they're stressed, they may not be able to problem solve and talk their way out of certain situations, which is important when someone may have suicidal ideation. As a therapist, we're there. We may see someone once a week. Many times we're teaching skills that they can use later. So I would be concerned if a youth would not have the ability to be able to problem solve and think through things.
And from your clinical practice then, what interventions do you find to be most effective when working with adolescents with depression, and I suppose in particular with those with young people who are struggling to get their sense across?
As I mentioned, I'm a cognitive behavior therapist, and that's what I've been trained. So I typically use cognitive behavior therapy. Treating with depression has been shown to be effective. Depression and comorbid conditions such as anxiety disorder. So oftentimes that the youth that I see may have depression, anxiety, as well as suicidal ideation and behaviors. Also, interpersonal psychotherapy has been shown to be effective in treating adolescent depression. Currently, there's limited data in how well these interventions work for youth of color. And so that is something that many times we're trying to make sure apply to fit with our population. In my practice, CBT is my base, but I also utilize strategies from other evidence-based treatments fit with the patient. Our clinical team at CHOP, our Child and Adolescent Mood Program, we're also using dialectical behavior therapy groups and techniques with our patients to address both depression and the suicidal ideation behavior and cutting behaviors that come up. And many times youth may participate in individual therapy, group therapy. So we use, as well as see a psychiatrist for medication that we use, combination treatments, especially for the youth who are more severe. One thing that is also very important is the parent involvement in treatment. And this could vary even for adolescents, parents. We need to have them involved. It could be check-ins about treatment planning. It could actually be focusing on particularly parenting skills to help them manage a youth with both depression and suicide risk, which is very stressful for parents, and sort of helping with communication skills and things like that. And also providing psychoeducation to the family about treatment with depression, suicide risk, safety planning, and how all that can be implemented at home. And sometimes some families need more family therapy as a supplement also.
When one hears that suicide and suicidal behavior runs in families, it does feel a bit hopeless. What would you say to young people who may be worried about this because of their family history, and also to clinicians who may encounter young people with those concerns?
One of the things that we know, even though there's a biological risk, is not a one-to-one relationship. So not all youth who have a family history of suicidal behaviors will make an attempt. Some of them will be entirely fine. One of the things I do want to emphasize both the youth and is to make sure that they seek mental health treatment early if they begin to exhibit any socio-emotional difficulties. The goal is to prevent suicide behaviors and attempts. And so getting help early is key. If for clinicians, if they're seeing young people, they're probably already a problem identified because they're seeking help. And so they need to provide psychoeducation to the family about the risk of potentially suicidal behaviors, but also if the parents could be or siblings could still have these issues, and they may need to get their own treatment. So sometimes you have to take this family approach to being able to help one youth.
Rhonda, you mentioned before that there has been limited research on the effectiveness of interventions such as CBT on people of colour. And we're talking about young people of colour. Have you been doing any particular research on this?
I have not yet. That is something I'm hoping to do. I was part of a work group recently for the United States Congressional Black Caucus. It's an emergency task force on Black youth suicide and mental health. And we reviewed the current research literature, looking at sort of what was out there and what was needed. One of the big issues that recent trends is that there's been increased deaths by suicide for Black children 12 and under compared to white children. And then there's been increasing rates of suicide attempts among Black teens in the U.S. over the last decade. And so when we looked at what is happening, we made recommendations and tried to figure out what is happening. I think there's a lot we don't know. And so my team and I, that is sort of our goal, what we're hoping to do, contribute to the research literature, trying to understand sort of why mm-hmm. this is happening, but also testing interventions that are culturally appropriate to be able mm-hmm. to make sure. The current research suggests that most of the interventions that work with children of color have been adapted. And so that is probably the way in which to move to research forward about sort of understanding how to make these cultural adaptations to the interventions that currently work, or to actually test to see how they work in different populations of youth of color.
Why do you think there's been such a dearth in the research in this area then?
I think things go through kind of different trends of sort of what happens and where research is funded. One issue that comes up is that research with children and adolescents kind of fall behind compared to research with adults in general. Also, doing work that are cultural adaptations many times take a long time, and it's sometimes hard to get funded to do the work. And so if there's not research funding to support it, then it's hard to do the work without that support financially to do it. And then there's sometimes people argue whether you can adapt something for every group. And so sometimes there's backlash in that, and trying to find that medium of how to do the work and engage in communities too is important, which it takes a lot of time to do that, to make sure it fits with the population.
Rhonda, you are a faculty member at the Policy Lab at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, known as CHOP, and also Associate Director of CHOP's Child and Adolescent Mood Program. The Policy Lab has an evidence-to-action approach. Can you give some examples of how that works?
Yes, this approach is taking the research that the faculty do and translating it to be useful for policymakers, community, and other stakeholders. So typically, as you mentioned, we have a paper published. As an academic, we put papers in journals, but oftentimes the community never knows about them. Policy Lab is, they have a team of a communications team, a policy team to help us think through what our research means, the implications, how to strategize to send it out to different audiences. So it's put in kind of a shorter form. So they do policy briefs, blogs, use social media. Also, there's times where there's a current issue that comes up, policy issue, in which they will gather a team together to write up what the current research says and kind of where things need to go. And I find this kind of exciting work to do with Policy Lab because we want our work out there. We want people to be able to use the research that we do.
You serve as a director of research training for the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Fellowship at CHOP. Why is evidence-based research so important when it comes to children and young people's mental health?
Our department has a 2-year psychiatry fellowship, which has a research requirement. And so I oversee that component and assist the fellows in locating appropriate research lab to work during their last year of their fellowship. I think it's important to understand the process of research and how to critically evaluate the research literature. For all mental health professionals, particularly child and adolescent mental health professionals, as I say, the research is not as abundant as it is with the adult research literature. One of the things is that we have a huge research practice gap. And so we want to be able to get the research that we know out into the field, into practitioners. Yeah. And so we want to decrease the lag time in which research is out in the field. And we want to make sure that youth are getting the appropriate care for their psychiatric disorder. And so this makes it important to be able to focus on evidence-based research because it does change. Things that we knew 10 years ago have changed. And so we need to make sure that people are updated in the field. And it's sometimes hard to do that. As I say, people don't always read journal articles. And so we have to find other ways to get things out, you know, through CMEs or CUs or certain ways. And I think things like podcasts and webinars with the internet has opened up possibilities of training people at larger levels now.
What can be done in your view then to speed that up and make that translation of research into practice to ensure it's more current?
I know people are often now are doing designs more effectiveness hybrid research where they're doing it in practices. Because some of the issues with when you think about intervention therapy trials, they're done with efficacy. So you may start off testing them in a very controlled environment. You have to test that through multiple trials, and then you get out into the community and practice, which the patient population fits differently. Then you have to figure out how it translates to providers. So now people are trying to quicken the time, develop trials in which they're testing the efficacy as well as doing it within community settings with patients that may be more diverse in their clinical presentation so that we can move it quickly. And also with implementation science, looking at what factors help implementing it in like a real world setting. That area, moving that forward and making that more common is important. The old style of taking things through all these trials before it goes to the community is not working.
Rhonda, what other research areas are coming up for you?
I wanted to mention about a trial that I currently am working on. My co-principal investigator, Dr. James Guevara, and I, he's a pediatrician and a professor at Chapin Penn. We're conducting a randomized control trial of a parenting intervention that was adapted onto Facebook for postpartum mothers screened positive for postpartum depression symptoms at the pediatric well child visits. So these are the early visits, 2, 4, and 6 month well child visits at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. We conducted a previous trial. It was a pilot, pretty small, in which we adapted the intervention and we compared our adapted intervention with the in-person intervention. And our findings show that women in the social media intervention had increased parenting competence and they had decreased depression symptoms from baseline to post-intervention compared to the in-person group. And the attendance was high for the social media intervention, but very poor for the in-person intervention. And one of the things that we do realize that it is maybe hard, especially for a mother who just had a baby, to be able to come out for group interventions. And so the Facebook intervention allowed more flexibility to be able to get the parenting intervention. So we now are currently testing this social media intervention in a larger trial that's funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. The women received either the social media parenting intervention plus a web-based CBT intervention, or they receive only the web-based CBT intervention. And we're currently in this first phase looking at how it impacts parenting. And we're doing mother-infant interactions that are coded. So it's more independent of parent report. And we're also looking at depression symptoms over time. We're excited about that intervention. It was affected by COVID. We had to stop for about a while, but we're back on track recruiting virtually. And so we're excited about being able to do an intervention that can be done on social media that can eventually hopefully be scalable and disseminated.
And very timely, actually, because of COVID.
Yes.
In terms of that need to roll out more remote working. What's the sort of timescale on that? When can you imagine there'll be some sort of interim results?
We should be able to probably finish it within maybe 6 months, that first part, 6 months to a year, I guess. And then we can write up the initial findings. COVID affected, I guess, as you know, everything shut down research wise. Yeah. And so, one of the things that we are trying to figure out, we think mothers are probably not going to their doctor's appointments as frequently as they also, because they were screened in the pediatrician offices. But I'm hoping within a year, hopefully we will have some new data. And the way this grant is written, we had the first affect parenting, and then we move on to the second phase in which we tested to look at child outcomes, and that we will eventually look at whether it affects child developmental outcomes.
What else is in the pipeline that you'd like to mention?
One of the things, as I started saying, that I've been hoping to collaborate with some researchers to look more at research looking at youth depression and suicide is one of the areas in which I've been hoping to focus. My team, we just published a paper, I guess it just came out online with our data registry, looking at sort of different risk factors for youth presenting with mood symptoms in our clinic, looking at bullying behaviors, trauma, maltreatment, and looking at how it impacts youth functioning. We noticed that did a cluster analysis and we showed that youth were presenting that with maltreatment, as well as being perpetrators of bullying, as well as being victims of bullying and fighting behaviors, and that those youth who had high levels of both maltreatment as well as the bullying involvement, which we called the web of violence, because we noticed that the kids were actually being victims as well as also perpetrators, that they had worse clinical outcomes. And these are youth that already were presenting with clinically. And so they had higher hopelessness. They had higher impairment. They had higher depression symptoms. And so it makes it important for us to think about how we assess kids, and that we need to look at all violence involvement youth are experiencing. And particularly when kids come in with internalizing symptom, we don't view them as sort of participating in like fighting and also perpetrating, but that we need to look at it more comprehensively, I think is important. So that is kids with depression and anxiety. We don't usually view them as youth who may be bullying other people and externalizing our youth who have more aggressive behavior, more attention, acting out. And so those are the youth we tend to associate with some of the bullying behaviors, but many times it's youth are not sort of just one thing. And I think sort of the complexity, gathering information, what kids may be experiencing and why is important to gather, because it increased their risk factors of how their symptom presentation. And it's also knowing that information, then we can do interventions that may focus on how to address those issues. Because oftentimes they have depression. Irritability is a symptom that we tend to see who have depression, which is not typical for adults. So youth have irritability, which also could be in addition to their sadness. But it could be interpreted if they're irritable, they may snap at people, get annoyed easily, and that impacts their interpersonal relationships. They may be mean or interpreted as mean by other people. And so when youth are presenting that, you know, they're having trouble with friends and classmates, sort of understanding what may be going on, that they may be contributing to some of it also because of their depression symptoms, as well as then they're receiving it back. And so how to stop those negative interactions so that they have more positive interpersonal relations with people that will help in their recovery from the depression. That paper is out online. It just came out, but we're still trying to follow up on different information. So it came out probably in May online. And it's part of a special issue looking at sort of comorbidity across youth violence behaviors. And so because we have a data registry, we're developing several different projects in which we're hoping to follow up and look at sort of understanding risk and protect the factors for youth who are presenting with depression in our clinic.
Finally, Rhonda, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
One of the things I do want to emphasize is that depression and suicidal behaviors are significant problems. They are increasing. All the current research that comes out when they update it, this is a huge problem. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for children and youth. And so we need to address this. I think it's something that needs to become a priority, and that particularly we need to focus on interventions. There's a piece of child understanding what happens, but we know these youth need to be treated, and we need to figure out sort of what are the appropriate ways to screen to make sure youth are not missed, that we have interventions that are accessible in environments and with youth present, whether that's school, in community settings, and making sure that they're culturally appropriate for all the populations of youth that are needed.
Great. Thank you. And are you optimistic that that will happen?
Yes, I have to be, because I couldn't do this. Yes, I'm optimistic that people recognize that there's a crisis, that we need to help our youth. And part of it is that depression, suicidal behaviors, they have significant impact into adulthood. Youth who have depression, they many times may go through different episodes all the way into adulthood. Then they're at risk when they have children, the girls later, and as I'm studying, they say postpartum perinatal depression. So it's all linked together.
Well, just thank you ever so much. For more details on Dr. Rhonda Boyd, Please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.